Welcome to Mulling It Over with Brandon Mole.
Hi, I'm Brandon Mole. I'm a number one New York Times bestselling author of a bunch of fantasy series like the Fablehaven series and many more.
And I'm Jason Conforto. I'm a filmmaker, a podcaster, and game designer. In this podcast, we're excited to share our love for story and our passion to create.
We hope to share a bunch of experiences and lessons learned over a lifetime in creative fields.
Today, we have with us somebody who's not Brandon Mole.
Yeah, I'm very excited to have my friend Shannon Hale.
Yeah, Shannon Hale is with us today. Shannon, thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure. Thanks.
Yeah. So we thought with this podcast, it'd be good to have guests on every now and then. And we're going to do a little peek behind the curtain. When we record these episodes, we actually record three in a row. So when Shannon said she'd be on an episode, she actually committed to being on three episodes.
What?
3 months worth of episodes. So thanks for being here with us today as we talk about some stuff.
Yeah. Shannon is the best-selling author of things like Princess Academy and Goose Girl and Princess in Black and Rapunzel's Revenge and many other awesome stories. So she is very talented and very insightful, and I'm excited that she'll be part of this conversation.
Yeah, that's going to be great. My first introduction to Shannon was actually listening to Goose Girl on a road trip with our kids, and my daughter, who was like 7 or 8 at the time, got too scared and made us turn it off.
Oh,
Now, out of all our kids, she's your biggest fan, and she loves your books and reads them all the time. But yeah, we had to. So I don't know how Goose Girl ends, but we left it in a
so
dark
much
spot.
Murder.
So well, good. Well, today we're going to talk about advice for young writers. So Brandon mentioned that's the number one question that he gets asked when you go on book tours and other things is advice for young writers. And so we thought we'd get into a conversation about that. But before we do, Shannon, I'd love to hear about how you got started writing and tell us a little bit about kind of how your career launched.
Sure. I always loved making up stories when I was little. Writing wasn't an option. Like, we did not have podcasts or have authors come to our schools. It didn't seem like a viable career in the 1980s, but I was always making up stories that I had complicated ideas for games that I would act out with my friends or plays I'd put on with my siblings. And then in fourth grade, we had a teacher that did a creative writing workshop where we wrote poems and short stories, and I just instantly was like, yes, because I love to read. And so I started writing books when I was 10, and I never managed to finish any. So I am an expert
at starting books.
That's right. So I have so much empathy for all of the young readers out there. They're like, I start, but I can't finish. Yeah, you and me both.
I hear that all the time.
Oh, yeah. It's very common, and there's nothing wrong with it.
And I lived it, too. I did the same thing as a kid, so a lot of the time, yeah.
For sure. So I kept writing, but as I got older, I noticed there was this sort of judgment when you told people you wanted to be a writer of, like, it felt like saying, I want to be a princess
That's
when
cute,
I grow
kid.
Up.
Yeah.
And
I'm going to be a superhero.
Exactly.
That's my life plan.
When my brother was 3, I asked him what he wanted to be when he grew up, and he told me either Zorro or a hippopotamus. And that's always been my ideal for dreaming big.
Yeah. And your parents were probably more encouraging to him than to the idea of being a writer.
Shot at this hippo thing.
They're like, a hippo, you could land that.
I could see that for you. Yeah. He says that's the one that he has actually accomplished at this point. But then when I did theater, so that was another kind of storytelling. I studied English in college, and I kind of thought maybe I would be an English teacher, but it was my way to secretly keep reading and writing.
So even in college, it was to become an English teacher more than it was to become a writer.
Well, that's what I told people. It was always my goal.
But deep down inside, you knew.
I'd really avoided telling people. I was really embarrassed.
Mm-hmm. I did the same thing. Did we all?
I mean, I think there were probably some of those bold kids that were like, this is what I'm going to do. You can't stop me now.
I'm wearing a beret and a cape. And
just going all in, you know. Yeah, no, I was too afraid.
Because I would outright lie about it.
Yeah.
Like, what do you think you're doing? I'll probably get an MBA.
Yes.
I was trying to like say like marriage worthy things to girls.
Yes.
I did the same thing with so I do film for a living, and I studied communications in college so that I could be adjacent to film stuff. And then one day I was like,
you're like, because there's a big future in Morse code.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think it was when I was in my like comms law class, I was like, I'm only here because I want to make movies. Let's drop the facade and just actually go for it and do that.
It's really scary. It's really scary to put yourself out there because it's like you're saying, I think I'm good enough to do what most people think is impossible.
Yeah. Right.
And I didn't necessarily think I was good enough. But when I was tapped into that kind of deeper self, I knew that's what I was yearning to do.
Yeah.
So it didn't come out of I'm going to show everybody that I got it, because I was also deeply insecure about it.
Yeah.
But also there was nothing else that was going to bring me real joy.
So what was your first book that you finished writing then?
When I was in undergrad, I realized that I had started all these novels and not ever finished one. And I'd done a lot of short stories, but that's not where my love was. That's great for practice. Writing something short because I could complete it and then actually revise it, which is such an essential part of becoming a writer.
Yes.
So I was like, I need to just write something to finish it. And we didn't have a lot of fiction books in my home. I lived with my parents still. And I was looking at the fiction bookshelves, and there were these ones that were like middle grade realistic novels that my sister had probably gotten from a book club when she was in school. And I sat down and I read it in one sitting, and I was like, okay, you're going to write one of those, because I thought maybe that was like the easiest thing. In my head, I was always going to be like a fantasy writer for adults. Mm-hmm. I was not going to write for children. And so I did. I gave myself a goal for the summer, and I wrote probably like a 30,000 word novel, and I finished it. And I realized nobody would want to read this.
Right.
This is terrible. But it was a really good exercise in terms of completing something and just be able to like, I can actually do that.
Yeah.
And then I officially kind of went all in when I decided to get an MFA in creative writing.
Oh, awesome.
So that was my big step of like, okay, this is my crossing the Rubicon. I'm actually going to pay for an MFA. There's nothing reasonable.
So I got to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like there's no other like career with an MFA in creative writing,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Like
I'm going to be a dentist someday, but I want this background.
Yeah.
There's no point. And also because you don't need an MFA. You don't need any kind of degree or certification or anything to be a writer.
Right.
You just need, you know, the manuscript. But for me, it was a way to say, I'm going to spend 2 years taking this seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And no one can teach you how to write. It was really just about the time.
Right.
And being around other freaky writers, which I didn't know anybody. I had no other really writing friends. I was not part of a community. So that was a way to tap into that. And it was while I was at... I went to the University of Montana, and I met a friend who also loved fantasy, and I was like, oh, I did love fantasy when I was younger, but I stopped reading it as I got older because it felt like it was something you outgrew, and that was really tragic to me. So we both challenged each other to write a fantasy novel over the summer break between first and second year, and that's when I started writing The Goose Girl, which became my first novel. I wrote the first 80 pages of it that summer. I was going to write the whole novel.
right.
And I wrote 80 pages and they were horrible. And I threw away almost all of them. Not a single sentence from the first draft of Goose Girl remained in the final draft. So
Is that typical for your writing now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I revise a lot, but it was a great kick in the pants and I discovered I did like it. And so when I got home, I got married and then immediately said, I'm not going to start working until my student loan kicks in and I'm going to spend that time trying to finish this novel. So I kept working on it and then my student loans kicked in and then I had to put it on the side and I would email myself pages every day at work. And on my lunch break, I was so antisocial that on my lunch break, I was revising on my computer the pages that I'd emailed from home and then I'd email them back home and I kind of revised that way. It took me like 3 or 4 years to finish it.
I want to hear about that moment when you find out that it's going to get published. But what steps did you take when you realized, hey, I've got something good here? What did you do next?
Do you know, one of the biggest boosts for me in all of that, because I didn't have any, I didn't know anybody in publishing. Mm-hmm. I didn't know anyone who was in the industry. Thankfully, it was the beginning of the internet. So I was able to read people's blogs and find published people who wrote about their process so I could kind of figure out, what am I supposed to do? Because I was just lost. I started sending out letters to agents because I knew you're supposed to get an agent and I just don't ever hear back. I mean, sent so many letters, or not just letters. I sent the whole manuscript and they just never even send them back. You know, you just,
yeah.
You printed it all up, but we weren't emailing large things back then.
And the 1800s. Most disheartening thing to hear is just a flat nothing.
Yeah, right? Worse than a no.
Where it is. Like, it is worse than
it's like, note. Really, like, did you shred it unopened? Did you, did it mean nothing that I wrote it and sent it? Like, and to some people, yeah, it kind of meant nothing, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, absolutely. Yeah, right. It did. But I printed up a copy and I gave it to my mom to read. And she went and had it bound, you know, just like the spiral binding at Kinko's. Mm-hmm. And she read, or at first I just gave her like half of the pages. And she came to my house like 10 p.m. one night and said, can you print up the rest? Like, she couldn't even wait till morning.
That's
and
a
honestly,
good sign,
that
right?
moment was huge for me.
That's awesome.
And so after she had all of it, she spiral bound it and she started loaning it to people. And then I just started hearing from actual people who read it. And it seemed like, you know, they might have just been being nice, but it actually seemed like, like people were telling me they were fighting over it with their siblings and reading on vacation aloud, and every night everybody would gather, like it felt like a thing.
Right.
And that, and so in the long haul of trying to get it published, I kind of hung on to.
But that's what gave you hope, right?
That gave me hope.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think if you didn't have that, do you think you would have given up?
It very possible.
Yeah.
Because there was no, I don't think I would have stopped writing.
Right, right, right.
But this was such I wrote a fantasy novel. I didn't know what I'd done. I didn't know if I did it right. I didn't know, you know, there's no guarantees in this sort of thing. Yeah. You write because you love to write, but you can't control any of the outcome.
So tell me when you finally got a yes or a response.
So I had a friend who moved to New York and I told her, you got to meet someone in publishing for me. And so she did. She met somebody who worked at an agency who was not an agent. And honestly, I don't know if anybody would have ever even read it if it hadn't been for that. So that was really lucky. And her name is Amy Lou Jamison. And she took me on. She wanted to become an agent, so she took me on as her first client. She was an assistant to another agent there. And then she sent it everywhere, and everybody rejected it.
Oh, gosh.
It just like the who's who of many publishers I publish with now. I've got the rejection letters. One of them said that my writing was stiff, cliched, and self-conscious.
Oh, gosh.
And those adjectives have stayed with me for time and all eternity.
Yeah, you just rattled them off.
Yeah.
That should be a great title for one of your books someday.
Stiff, cliched, and so I'm going to do that.
Yeah, that would be a good self-help book.
You know, and honestly, no hard feelings for the people who rejected me. Sure. It's just like it wasn't right for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's how it struck them that day and that mood or whatever, you know.
Just like, you know, we all read books that people love and recommend, and then you read it and you're like, I can't get into this.
Yeah, this isn't my thing.
Yeah, and maybe 10 reason. Years from now or 10 years in the past it would have been, but it's not right now or not, maybe just not
and,
today.
And I'm sure by the time it got published, there were some revisions that happened even after that manuscript as well. And so
it was pretty solid, actually.
Was it at
that
point?
Yeah, it was pretty much the
it had, was what
I had
it was,
done
huh?
like yeah. 30 drafts.
Okay, okay.
I did do some
revision.
So
these people are just fools.
I had done some revision with my editor afterward, but no, not extensively, actually, just because I had spent so many years and I had had a lot of other readers give me feedback and mm-hmm. I had worked on it for years.
But that's really telling and nice to hear, because it can let aspiring writers know, hey, you might have something really good.
Yeah.
And you might hear so much negativity about it.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it might be good and polished and ready, and someone just read a couple pages, or someone just wasn't in a good mood, or just someone wasn't expecting it to be good, and so they couldn't see it as good.
I think all these things can
block getting that yes that you're so desperate to get sometimes.
You know? I think one of those big issues, too, is it's an insider's club, right? So why take a bet on you, who was not Shannon Hale at the time, right?
Yeah.
Why take a bet on this unnamed author
when
we've got people that they're writing their 5th, 6th, 7th, 20th, 40th book?
And since I've learned, it was a particular time in children's book history, which was just a downturn. So what had happened was children's publishing was always considered, I don't know if this is too nerdy. Is this too nerdy?
No, it's not.
It was always considered the charity branch of publishing houses. They
nice.
Didn't make money. They usually didn't come out in hardcover. Even like back then, like books that there wasn't even a New York Times bestseller list for children's books for a long time. And even if like Newbery winners, like they wouldn't even put the medal on the cover because nobody even really cared. And then there were a few books that started to change that, but of course the big one was Harry Potter. Mm-hmm. And as soon as they saw that something could not just be big, but the biggest thing right. in publishing, and in fact floated the whole, I mean, Scholastic is a big, one of the big, big publishers, and that was like 80% of their income was just Harry Potter. It was so huge that they started going all in on middle grade fantasy, and then nothing was as big as Harry Potter.
Yeah.
And so right when my book was going out, everybody was taking a downturn and being like, this is not a great time. Mm-hmm. We've come behind a lot of middle grade fantasies, and they haven't really shown, they don't have a lot of legs. So everybody was kind of pulling back from it right at that time. Of course, I didn't know that.
Right.
So there's, I mean, what all that to say is it's capricious.
Yeah.
It's not a meritocracy. There's so much luck and circumstance, and there's so much you can't control.
Right.
And 20 plus years now publishing, what I always come back to is what I can control, which is only what I'm writing right now. And you do your best, and then you have to let go of any of the results.
Yeah. That's so healthy, though, to be able to look at it with that attitude of like, hey, what am I in charge of? I'm in charge of writing this book, and that's what I can focus on. And then we'll let luck and fate and everything else kind of dictate from
there
a little bit.
There's nothing else you can do. I mean,
and if you take your eye off that, you tend to do much worse work.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You know, because you're not writing from that place of joy or true interest, or, you know, like you start writing from what do they want to see, or what does someone else want to see?
Vampires are hot right now. I should write a vampire book.
And you may write a vampire book, and it may sell very well.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it does hit. And I've written books from joy, from a place of joy, that did not find a readership.
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess it's easy at this point. I've published, I think, 45 books at this point to, you know, really realize, oh, there's so much variation. There's so little control. It does make it easier to be pretty zen at this moment. And I think I don't see a lot of writers who can spend too many years in publishing unless they get into that zen. Otherwise, they're tearing their hair out and going crazy because there is so little control. I mean, the film industry would be another classic example
for
of that.
Sure.
Honestly, having done a little bit in that arena, I don't know how anything gets made, ever. At least with a book, I can write a manuscript.
Right.
I can be one person and create one book. When you've got so many people involved in a film, and everything, talk about capriciousness, one person one day just like decides, never mind, and it all falls apart.
Yeah, I was on one of the biggest crews I was on. It was like 60, 70 people for a Teen Vogue cover magazine shoot. It was just a still shoot, and there was all these people there doing their things, just hundreds of thousands of dollars being poured into this like one little still framed image, and my team was interviewing the star of the magazine or of the cover and doing that. But yeah, it was
65 people crew for
one little photo shoot. And really the majority of the work was the photographer and their assistant. You know, hair, makeup, wardrobe obviously played a huge role, but like, yeah, it was crazy.
Anyway, probably seemed a little ridiculous.
Yeah,
it
was
that
way, way, way over the top, way over the top. But tell me, so when did the yes happen though?
So Amy Lou Jameson, she sent my manuscript around, and it was about a year into the process, rejection, rejection, rejection all the time. And these people were actually reading it. So that was kind of what was heartbreaking, is we were getting the personal letters now, mm-hmm. because I had an agent.
Yeah.
And saying no.
Yeah.
Stiff, cliched, and self-conscious. And then there was a new publisher, Bloomsbury. They had published the original Harry Potter in the UK, but they didn't have a US branch. So Scholastic got it in the US, and they were like, wait a minute, maybe we should have a US branch. So it was literally three people worked at this publisher, and I was the second book that they acquired. And it was just the editor. I ended up doing like a dozen books with her. She just liked it, you know?
Awesome.
It just happened. So I get a call from Amy that says, she got a call from Victoria Wells Arms at Bloomsbury, and she said she'd like to make an offer. And I was I had been laid off from my job. I was at home. Like,
no matter what the offer is, the answer is yes.
Yeah, no, I would have for free, 100%. Yeah. I would have, I'm so lucky.
I owe
lucky.
Them how much to print this?
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm so lucky I had a legitimate agent that was not going to try and take advantage of me. Sure, I was so desperate. I would have done anything.
Yeah. Pay me in arcade tokens.
Yeah. Yes. For
pay me in coupons.
Absolutely. 50 cents off dog food and I don't have a dog. I would have been, yes.
Yeah.
But she... What the crazy thing was that she said she was going to make an offer, and then 2 weeks went by, and she didn't make an offer. Oh, and gosh. I spent 2 weeks not barely eating, barely sleeping. I mean, I was just a mess. And then finally,
it's an
when
awful
the offer
kind
came,
of suspense. Sometimes suspense is the most terrible emotion.
Oh, yeah. It was so hard to be zen in that moment. But the offer was $8,000 to publish a book that I'd spent 4 years on.
And so, that's what you're charging us to be on the podcast today. So it's
evens out. Yeah, it balanced out.
This works.
I gave you guys a discount. And you're going to pay me in coupons.
Yeah, dog food.
So it was, it's not a lot. You know, it was not a lot of money. And Amy got it up to $10,000. Then she takes 15% off the top. And
which got it back to.
It didn't matter. It didn't matter. And that book was never a bestseller. But it's been 21 years since it came out. And it's been through, I don't know how many, but over 30 printings. So when a book is reprinted, the publisher, that says that it sold more than the publisher was expecting.
Nice.
And so if you keep getting reprinted, then that means it's continuing to sell. And so 21 years, the odds of having a book still in print 21 years later are astronomical. And for me, like more than like awards and bestseller lists, that's like the gold standard.
That is awesome. That's really, really cool. With that moment, did you have that sense of like, I did it. I'm a writer.
Yeah. Honestly, there's no high in the world that has met that.
Yeah.
Publishing my first book. Yeah. Every part.
Including all your children and your spouse and all that.
Yeah. Forget
them. Yeah.
Lots of folks got kids.
The Goose Girl didn't ask me to feed them and entertain it.
Anybody
can
get a kid.
That's easy.
But that's the difference because when you get a kid, it's not like, I mean, labor and pregnancy aside, which you don't understand.
Nope.
It's not a picnic.
No.
But it's still.
You earned that kid.
It's like the organism of my body was doing that. You know, it's not like I was making a goal and setting goals every day to like make a child. And you know what I mean?
Now I'm working. Wait,
different.
Quiet, honey. I'm working on the pancreas.
Right.
On those eyeballs.
So when you write a book, it's like, all the books you read and everything, all the practice writing you did and all the revisions you did and, you know, it's building up for decades to the point where you made something that I couldn't have made 5 years before. I couldn't have made 10 years before. And I molded myself to be the kind of person and the kind of brain and everything about me to be something that I could create this. And a novel takes so much time and it's incremental labor that you're doing a little bit day after day after day for years, and then to have it published and accept it. Yeah, there's no other high to meet it. And I've done other books since, but it's all wonderful, but
That first one.
Yeah.
And you would agree with that, your first one, Brandon?
Oh, by far.
Yeah.
Like, just because, so I got paid $8,000 less than Shannon.
Okay.
Or, I guess $10,000 less if you count me not having an agent.
Which is what we're paying you to be on the podcast today.
Yeah. So. Exactly right.
Negative $10,000.
Yeah. And so all it was we'll publish it and you'll get a percentage of whatever sells. But that one's still in print too.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's the fact of crossing that threshold where that was a goal that seemed like for a stretch of years seemed like it would never happen. And then it was happening. Hey, there was an actual publisher who was actually publishing it and I would have a chance for it to reach the marketplace. And that was everything to me. That meant so much to me. Like there was never a higher high or something that felt less within reach that happened than that.
That's awesome.
And the great thing too, that I can pontificate about now looking back is that there was no expectation for huge success. Yeah. So I wasn't just, when they said $8,000, I was like, yay, you know, I wasn't expecting a big advance. I wasn't waiting on the Wednesday after publication to hear if it made the New York Times bestseller list. I didn't know that was a thing or what day it came out or there was no expectations of any of it. So there was no disappointment. Like everything was the cherry on top. And I have known people who their first book sold for just big, big bucks. And it was a different kind of experience. Mm-hmm. But I think also people that knew more about publishing and were hoping for the big advance that didn't happen. So there was, you know, disappointment as well. But there's pros and cons to everything. But for me, there was no cons. It was just all pro. And yeah. At the time, I remember hearing that once you have five books in print, you can make a living from it. And I was like, that's my goal.
Yeah.
After I got five books in print, I was like, no one can make a living. We had to readjust.
I could have thrown a sixth book now.
Yeah. I think it was after 15 books that Dean quit his day job and we first started trying to make a living at it. And then that's a whole other situation when you're trying to make this thing that you're doing on your lunch breaks into something, into making it your career, mm-hmm. and you know, trying to meet deadlines and working with the business side of all of that is totally different than the creative side of it. It's a very strange industry.
Well, let's back up a little bit and talk about how we create this for young writers. So if you were to give some advice to young writers who are, you know, assuming that they have started a book that they can't finish, what kind of advice do you give these kiddos?
Yeah, well, let's even start with, if you could go back and speak to young Shannon, what would you tell young Shannon? Like with from what you see now, to help young Shannon develop, what would be the advice?
So that's where I get weird with advice, is because, you know, it worked out pretty well for me, and no one gave me advice.
Yeah.
And so I kind of feel like whatever you're doing is, that's where you are.
Yeah.
I don't know that I would have said anything different. I feel like for some reason with writing, once we are literate and we can make sentences, we expect ourselves to be able to do it perfectly. Mm-hmm. But no one gives kids a violin and a bow, and as soon as they start scratching it out, expects them to, you know, perform professionally.
Yeah.
I guess maybe I would just, you know, validate that writing is a skill and it takes years to develop and to be patient with yourself. But to have fun at it. And I think that was something that did work out for me, because I didn't have any exterior pressure. I was just writing for fun. Mm. I wrote because I wanted to. And if I didn't finish a book, I didn't kick myself, because who cared? Nobody knew I was writing one anyway. No one was waiting for it. So it was just this little adventure that I did inside. I had these stories in my head, and writing them down was a way to kind of figure out how to share them. But for fun, doing it for fun.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Look, that piece that you said about give it time. That is what I would tell myself if I could go back and talk to myself. I would say, hey, Brandon, you have time to get good at this. You don't have to be good at this all of a sudden.
Yeah.
You can try and find that the stuff in your head is cooler than what's on the page. And that can be okay for a while as you figure out how to make what's on the page match up better with what you see in your mind. There's a skill to it, right? Like, give yourself time to develop. That would be the number one piece of advice.
Yeah.
Like, to any kid out there who's writing something and goes, like, I have this awesome idea and what I see on the page isn't as cool as I want it to be.
Can I just pause right there?
Yeah.
Because if you can see that, that's awesome.
If
you can tell that what you had in your head is not what's on the page, that is a huge sign that you have just advanced to the next level. Because think about, you know, rewind a few years when you had something in your head and you wrote on the page and you showed it to people and you expected them to see in that what you had in your head. You didn't have the awareness yet that it wasn't matching up. So if you have the awareness now, good job.
Yeah.
That's great. Something.
Well, I remember when I first realized that, and it was crushing to me, because I was like, maybe this means what in my head is terrible, because what's on the page isn't what I want it to be. You know, and it took me a little bit of like growing up to realize, oh, it's okay if there's a gap for a while. And honestly, right now in my life, there's a permanent gap between how cool it is in my head and what I'm able to put on the page. There just is. Like, what I see in my mind, if people could see that, I would be a bigger celebrity than I am. You know what I mean? Like, because what I see in my head is really great, and I don't have the capacity to take it down into words. I just do the best I can, you know, and I'm still just doing the best I can. And I'm trying to do everything I can to get better at it, like today, tomorrow, yesterday. But when I was a younger writer, that gap was so painfully wide sometimes that it would just kill me as I stared at it.
Do you know, when I think about the Goose Girl, if I wrote it today, I'm a different writer than I am, mm-hmm. than I was, it would be a different book. I don't know necessarily that would be a better book.
Yeah.
You would think I would be a better writer now than I was then because I've had 20 plus more years of experience. But that also captured something that I was able to deliver at a certain time and place. So I would say keep everything you write, because even if it's not something that anyone else wants to read, it still has worth. And nothing is ever garbage. You're practicing like the, you know, I remember hearing like the Beatles, was it they kept less than 10% of what they would record in the studios. They kept less than 10%. And that is not including the time they spent writing the music.
Yeah.
And that has included the years they spent practicing their instruments. So it all this just, it does take a lot of time.
Prince is even a bigger example of that. He used to record a song a day. And we have so little of what he actually recorded. Yeah, he would do that. I get this question a lot too, in regards to film, and I think the advice that I give is similar to what you're saying. But some of the things that I always point out is think small, and I don't mean small like in like small ideas. I'm talking in scope. Like you don't want to start out with a 2,000 page manuscript of this big fantasy thing. Think something that's digestible. And so with film, I'm telling kids all the time, you know, what story can you tell in 15 seconds? What story can you tell in 30 seconds? What can you do in under 5 minutes? And keep that in mind, because the big, big advice that I have is always finish it, right? If you're going to start a project, finish it. And if your first book is so big that it takes you 20 years to write, you're never gonna finish it. And so you've got to get past that first hurdle of getting that first draft done so that you have something finished and able to show people.
It's good advice, and it's advice I wasn't able to take till my mid-20s.
Yeah.
So sometimes you start. I don't know. I guess what advice I'm leaning into more at this stage of my life is follow your energy. So yeah. I think sometimes why I hesitate around advice is because I think I'm just kind of talking, but I know for some people, it sounds like I am the voice of authority, you know, because of whatever reason. And then if what I'm saying doesn't match up with what they're doing, then it feels like they're doing it wrong.
Right.
And everybody's different.
And that's everybody fair. That's totally different. Fair. Yeah.
So whatever way that you're playing with it and figuring your stuff out, your journey is going to be different than anyone else's. And so I always want to just put a caveat of like, it's not going to look the way that I did it, the way Mull did it, the way anyone else is doing it. You're going to do your own thing.
Yeah. As long as you know you're not lying to yourself, right? If you're saying like, hey, what I do every day is I watch 10 hours of YouTube videos to get ideas to generate, like you know you're lying to yourself at that point.
Yes, that's a
great point. And so if your method is different than Shannon's or Brandon's, that's fine as long as you know you're actually working. You're actually doing stuff, and you're getting stuff
done. Well,
when
you have that goal, you know what you want, and then get making reasonable choices to help yourself get there. But it does take time. I remember, I don't know why this pops in my head as important, but I'll say it. When I was in grad school, I attended a poetry workshop, and the top poets in this program, which was a top 10 program in the nation, had submitted their poems, and they were really good poets. And then Jory Graham, who was a poet of, you know, like a former poet laureate, I think, she came and did this workshop, and she workshopped their poems that they had written. And she put one up on the board that I thought, oh, that's very good. That's really good. I'm not a poet, so I was just like flabbergasted at how good it was. And Jory Graham went through it and deleted half of it.
Oh.
But not just like the second half, like randomly words here and there. And then we read it, and it was a phenomenal poem.
Oh, wow.
And just by deleting, she had taken something that was great into something, I mean, catastrophically beautiful. And no one else could have done that because she just had the years and experience to see what needed to be there and what didn't need to be there.
Yeah.
And so when you're younger and you're writing this stuff, the poems or stories or whatever, you don't have the eye yet. To see what needs to be there and what not doesn't need to be there. And so if your measuring stick is what's published and what's out there and you can see it doesn't measure up, then you give up rather than giving yourself that time. So for younger readers, I want to be like, don't make a goal to write something that's publishable. Just how can you make it into a game for yourself?
Yeah.
How can it be play?
Yeah, I like that. I always try to tell kids to just be in the game, to be doing, if this is a goal, some of the things you should be doing is you should read a lot and you should write a lot. As you spend time writing, you'll figure out how to write. As you spend time reading, you'll educate your judgment so that you know what good writing sounds like. And that, I think, is fundamental enough that that's pretty universal. I mean, if you're not reading a lot and writing a lot, it would be hard to develop. You're not giving yourself soil and water and oxygen to grow.
You know? But then if you're giving yourself any shame for not reading enough or writing enough, and the word enough is so loaded.
Right.
Like, I want to remove any kind of shame and expectation from it altogether.
Yeah.
And the voice, us, the voice of authority here, telling you what you should or shouldn't be doing. The more you read, the more the stories, your brain's going to figure out what kind of stories you like, and your brain's going to start developing more stories. The more you write, the more you're going to be exercising those tools. What is enough? What does that look like for each person? Who knows?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, well, look, if you had to read super broad, I wouldn't be doing it. You know what I mean? Like I've got the kind of stuff I like and the kind of stuff I've read, and I like it hard, and I like it a lot, the stuff I like, but I'm not the most well-read guy. I'm just not. You know, do I like the stuff I like, and do I notice what's good about it and what I don't like about it? Yeah. And does that inform me a little bit as I go forward and do my stuff? Yeah. And as I write, do I figure stuff out? Yeah, that's all part of it for me. I hugely agree that anything artistic, when we give advice or give things that have been useful, the big asterisk is, hey, this has been useful for me. Yeah. Without this, I would have had a harder time. So I'm telling you something that was useful for me. And if you hear that and it makes something light up inside of you and you go, oh, that might be useful for me, then yeah, maybe it will be. And if you hear that and it just makes you die inside and you're like, that doesn't sound like something I want to do, then yeah, it doesn't work for you. And it's part of my process and not yours.
Yes, you know? That's the thing is, I think as you get older, hopefully we learn how to take what's coming at us and figure out what fits right with me, what feels right to me, and let the rest go.
Yeah.
But I remember being younger and not being able to sort that out yet. Right. So everything that's coming at me, I feel like I have to take that all in and I have to do that. And
this giant to-do list.
That. Yeah, or else I'm not going to, you know, succeed or whatever. So I guess maybe just being gentle with ourselves, with as we mature and figure stuff out and work on that skill of figuring out what is working for me and letting the rest go away.
That's awesome. I want to wrap things up real quick. But before we do, I do want to talk about just one other part of advice for young writers, which is the publishing side.
So when you start submitting your work, you are competing against all the best writers in the world, and you are competing against the most jaded and indifferent. You're being assessed by the most jaded and indifferent editors in the world. And so it's healthy to go into that expecting or ready to get tons of rejection and tons of indifference. It's the experience that I had. It's the experience that Shannon had. We have a lot of mutual friends who had experiences like that. Every rare now and then, there might be somebody who gets accepted very early on or very quickly, but that's a newspaper article. That's something that doesn't happen very often. If you reach a point where you are comfortable sharing your work, just be ready for it to be rejected. And if it gets rejected, that is not a publisher saying you did bad work. That's just them saying, we don't want to invest money into this thing that you've made.
Yeah.
Which is different than saying you're terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Though it feels like.
It feels like the opposite, which is why I have to still talk to myself about what they're really saying.
Yeah. It's hard. One thing we have a tendency to do as creatives is identify with the thing we've made. Mm-hmm. So we pour so much of ourselves into it. It feels very close to us. And then when someone rejects that thing, it feels like they're rejecting us. Yeah. And as primates, being rejected by our community feels like death. Just anything we can do to kind of, I like to actually do some physical actions where I like take the book, I like mime with my hands. I'm taking the book and I'm putting it in a space between me and my editor, wherever she is, or any reviewer or whatever. And that's what we're talking about, is that thing in between us. We're not talking about me. That can help ease that feeling of rejection that feels like death.
It's so personal.
I still get rejected.
Yeah.
So it doesn't stop. It never stops. Rejection happens all the time.
Yeah.
Every year, every month, there's different kinds of rejections that we still get. And it's part of if you could think about it instead of something stopping the process as something that's part of the process. And I, in a sort of metaphysical way, I like to think about it as the universe moving you into position to where you need to be. If my early stuff had been accepted, I would be writing short stories for The New Yorker.
Right.
And I don't think that that was my correct and best self called to that position. I'm much happier with where I am. And it's hard to, you know, be philosophical about it in the moment. But looking back, you can see, oh, this was better. That rejection actually was helpful at the time.
That's awesome. Great advice, you guys. Thanks for mulling it over with us today. Shannon, anything that you want to plug? Anything, any book that we should be aware of or project that you're working on?
I've got a new Princess in Black coming out. It's the 10th anniversary of Princess in Black, and book 11 comes out in September. And I have my very first board book coming out in my Itty Bitty Kitty Corn series.
Awesome. Well, check out all of Shannon's work, and you can check out some of Brandon's as well. That would be a good thing.
Yeah.
So thanks for joining us today.
Cool.
Hey there, fellow adventurers. I am Jason Conforto.
And I'm Tyler Crump, and we are hosts of a podcast, Adventure AI, where we play Dungeons & Dragons with an AI named Alex the Language Lord.
I'm Alex the Language Lord. Join us as we craft epic tales together.
Do you want to learn how to use AI in your D&D campaign?
Or how AI can force you to do things that you don't want to do? Wait a second, we don't like that.
Look no further. Adventure AI is the podcast for all your AI-powered D&D adventures.
Alex the Language Lord not only comes up with campaigns for us,
he also helps us create our characters, create our backstories, and even give us some fun magical items.
And really takes all of the human aspects out of Dungeons & Dragons. So it's not really playing at all.
Follow Adventure AI on whatever platform you listen to podcasts.